When she took the job, she was a smoker at the time. She only quit after she became the head of Britain's leading anti-smoking charity.
It's a consequence of an unintended consequence of the legislation and regulation of everything.
Yeah.
And it's just such a waste of time. And it's enough to turn you into a libertarian.
That's another one for the Advertising Standards Authority. There's one place I've ever been to where people are not loved and welcomed. It's London.
It's London.
The coldest, most friendly place in the country.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor at Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Not bad, Tom. London is crawling with children today.
It is Easter,
but apart from that, I'm doing okay. I hope you are too. Hello, viewers and listeners.
Hello, viewers and listeners, and a big hello to Dominic Frisby, the author, stand-up comedian, and also the author of a couple of Substacks, if you want to give those a plug.
Yes, I would love to give those a plug. Thank you very much. Hello, viewers. And Canary Wharf, where we are, is indeed crawling with children. and I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm a financial writer and a comedian, so if you like me for my comedy, please subscribe to frisbees.news. That's my comedy mailing list. And if you like me for my extreme opinions on financial stuff, it's theflyingfrisbee.com.
Perfect. Everyone should go and check those out. We're going to get into the nanny state stories, the nanny state developments over the course of the past couple of weeks. But before we did that, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the big news story today on Wednesday when we're recording this, Dominic, which is that the Supreme Court has announced what a woman is. There's been this big case that was going through the Supreme Court brought by a gender critical Scottish group against a piece of Scottish legislation. And it's essentially found that under the Equality Act, when it refers to women, it actually means women rather than someone who just believes themselves to be one. It's a really landmark moment, this, in a debate that has been going on for easily a decade now. It's been pretty torturous. There's been a lot of steps forwards and step back. What do you think? Will this actually kind of be a genuinely kind of significant milestone moment in this debate?
Well, as someone with she, her in his biography on LinkedIn and someone who likes to frequent women's changing rooms and women's toilets, I think this is a huge loss. It's obviously a huge win for common sense. And but the other part of me is just thinks it's insane that the amount of money that will have been spent and legislative time that will have been wasted on something that is just so basic and fundamental and obvious just seems, you know, mental. And also it shows you how nuts it is that we need lawyers and judges to tell us what a woman is when, you know, we don't even need biology to tell us. It's just patently obvious.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Chris, what do you make of this momentous day?
I didn't know this court case was happening. I want to know more about the court case. How long did it go on for? Did they call witnesses? And if so, who? call a scientist.
This was a small child who might know the difference between these two very complicated categories.
High courts. It must have been going on for a while.
No, it's been going on for a very long time. It goes back to something that the Scottish government brought in, which is that they wanted to kind of boost representation on public boards for women. But they decided that that category could also include people who aren't women. So as a consequence of that, you had a challenge.
That's a good way of getting around that rule, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You run a male-centered business.
So again, it was one of those things which naturally the gender critical campaigners took umbrage with. It became something which they brought cases against in Scotland itself, rattles through the courts, and it gets to this point. And it essentially was trying to settle what seemed to be this kind of conflict in law, because from about like 1975, the Sex Discrimination Act very clearly sets out that there are men and there are women and that there shouldn't be discrimination on those grounds, apart from in certain situations like changing rooms, toilets, what have you. You've got the Equality Act, which obviously recognises sex as a protected characteristic, but also has gender reassignment. So that was always something, what does gender reassignment mean? What does sex mean in that particular instance? And then the Gender Recognition Act, which was 2004, I think, which basically allows people to go and apply for a certificate which says that they are, you know, the opposite sex to what they were born in because they've been living in it for a certain amount of time, gives them certain kind of rights and allows them to change their birth certificate and so on. So you had this whole kind of mess of law.
Yeah.
And this case in particular came down to what is the kind of settled legal argument and fundamentally what does the Equality Act say? What does it mean when it says men and women?
Yeah.
And the justices in a pretty reasoned fashion said, if we start messing around with this, then the protection for pregnant women falls away. Our understanding of what any of these rights makes no sense if you start using these very subjective kind of ideological terms. So I mean, it does feel like it could be a big moment.
Mess of war is a phrase here, isn't it? Because nearly everything you've mentioned there I'm opposed to. And it seems to me if things like the Equality Act and regulations about who has to sit on the boards of companies, and indeed the Supreme Court didn't exist, none of this would be an issue, right? Yeah. I'm against the Equality Act. I'm against having the Supreme Court. I'm a bit iffy about having the Supreme Court making these decisions, because you can well imagine in a few years' time when you've got different people on the Supreme Court that might go completely the other way, and then we all have to abide by the law then, you know? This should just be a matter of private property rights and individual conscience and common sense, as far as I'm concerned. I'm delighted that they have finally, you know, they have done this, and I would be very entertained to see how they came to their conclusion and what witnesses gave evidence. But none of this should exist.
Yeah.
None of this should be a thing.
It is it's a consequence of an unintended consequence of the legislation and regulation of everything.
Yeah.
And it's just such a waste of time, and it's enough to turn you into a libertarian.
Join us. If you weren't one already. Before we move on, Chris, it's worth saying that Julian Moore was very upset by this. I mean, he wasn't
like him to be on the wrong side of a caucus.
No, absolutely. Because this is kind of what Julian did next, really, after Brexit and after going after the Tories for absolutely everything, was that he became a kind of crusader for trans rights. And he's expressed his not only...
But not Fox's rights.
Not Fox's rights. Because that's the one... he's not inclusive of Fox's, particularly not on Boxing Day, if they're bothering him while he's just... Mind his business.
That's the only cool thing he ever did, in my opinion. Kill
Alphonse. Exactly.
That's the one thing he got really good grief for.
The one point at which he related to him. But yeah,
I kept chickens, and I know what pain in the ass foxes can be. Yeah. I was like, go Team Jolly on.
They're vermin. Lawyers.
But everything other than that, he is the kiss of death, Julian Moore, isn't he?
He really is. Yeah, reverse Midas touch. Yeah, as soon as you saw him get behind it, you knew that probably the whole thing was going to peak. You know, there's going to be a vibe shift.
No, but that court time could be spent on cases that actually matter. I mean, yes. I'm not saying this doesn't matter, but you know what I mean? That deserve to actually exist.
Mm-hmm. Like prosecuting politicians for having bets, for example, Tom.
No, well, exactly. I know we're going to maybe save that for later, but given we're on the subject.
Well, it was such an obvious segue, I thought we might as well do it now.
No, we should. I think you're absolutely right. So this is the case that's been rumbling on since the election. Where everyone will remember in the run-up to last summer's election, there were a number of Tory politicians who were also kind of close advisors to Rishi Sunak, as well as kind of close protection officers, police officers and so on, who were implicated in this scandal where they had allegedly been betting on when the election was going to be, therefore seemingly benefiting from having that kind of insider knowledge of when it was going to be called. It was obviously a big shock when it was called when it was. And Chris, now there's been a number of charges brought under... essentially sort of cheating laws,
yes.
Which I didn't realise that
the law against cheating.
That was a clear-cut offence. But do you want to tell us a bit more about this? Because I remember you very confidently predicting
hold my hands up.
Yeah, I don't this wouldn't say. Come to anything. So
I'm eating humble pie and crow and my own words today, because I said nothing would ever come of this. It was all just a publicity stunt during the election. I still think it was largely a publicity stunt during the election. I think it was politically motivated. But obviously I was wrong that no charge would ever be brought. I am fascinated to know what's going to happen with this. It comes back actually a little bit to legal definitions, like what's the legal definition of cheating?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about this is that there is very, very little case law in this area. So it's been illegal to cheat at gambling, certainly since the Gambling Act of 2005 and probably since the Gambling Act of 1968. But you very rarely get cases go to court. What tends to happen is if a bookmaker or an operator is out of line in some way, the Gambling Commission gives it a fine because the Gambling Commission regulates those businesses. The Gambling Commission doesn't regulate individuals, thank God, and so it can only bring charges, which it hardly ever does, and it certainly hasn't done that I know of for this kind of thing before. I looked into this last July when all this was in the news, and it genuinely is a really grey area. But it seemed to me, from looking at the guidelines, really, of the Gambling Commission, that what happened with this election betting, where you had people in and around number 10, knew that it was going to be called in July and put money on it, that isn't really cheating. Knowing something that the bookmakers don't know is not cheating. It's for the bookmakers, it's just buyer beware. They don't have to lay these bets. You know, if Paddy Power want to start putting... you know, allowing people to bet on when the election's going to be, they're going to have to accept that there are people who's going to know more about that than people at Paddy Power. And that's just too bad for Paddy Power. You know, if you don't like that, then don't put the bet on. There are other examples like this of, you know, who wins The Apprentice or something. You know, it's recorded like 6 months previously. People know who wins The Apprentice. If you're going to put a book on for it, then you've got to accept that people might take advantage of it. I don't think that's cheating. I'm not sure at all that the case law says that that's cheating, but that's what it's about. I don't think any of these charges have been brought against MPs who bat themselves to lose,
no,
as quite a few did. And apparently this is a common thing in politics. I think they're all about the date of the election. I'd be very interested to see what the outcome of this is. I'm not going to make any predictions. I've got it wrong before, but I would be actually quite surprised if there are many, if any, convictions.
Potentially up to 2 years in prison.
Yeah, for cheating.
For cheating.
So don't cheat.
Exactly.
Listeners.
That's the take-home message. What do you think about this, Dominic?
Well, I my first thought on listening to Chris there was that has the Gambling Commission been, is it one of these sort of state bodies that's been politicised and it has, yes, it got it in for the Tories?
It's
along
out,
with every
it's
other
out of control.
Body.
I mean, the Gambling Commission is completely out of control. It's a law unto itself. Remarkably, the money that it gets from fines, it keeps. And it then distributes largely to anti-gambling groups.
A bit of a perverse incentive,
yeah.
Think,
well, yeah, it's kind of pretty almost corrupt, isn't it, you might say.
Yeah, show me the incentive and I'll show the outcome.
Yeah.
But, and are they prosecuting these specific ministers who bet on it?
It's not mostly ministers, actually. It's people, it's like spads, there's a police, okay,
they're prosecuting individuals who made these,
yes,
bets.
A policeman who's called Jeremy Hunt, very confusingly, got the hairs running. When that list, yeah, of the people who'd been had charges brought against them was first.
I mean, word gets around. I mean, this is another thing about this, right? You know, I spend a bit of time in Westminster.
So this is effectively a corrupt charge then. If it's just going for Tories and
well, this is unlikely the Labour would have known about it.
Yes.
So it's, you know, Rishi Sunak would have said to his spads, "I'm going to go for this July election." Then people can't keep a secret, can they? That would go to somebody else. As soon as you hear that information, you're going to tell somebody else. I could have been down the Red Lion that week and heard it on the grapevine and put money on Betfair. And now I'm up in court with the Gambling Commission for cheating. It doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah. I mean, I remember in the lead up to Brexit being told by a senior Brexiteer that Brexit was going to win about 3 or 4 days before the election, because he'd seen the postal votes, and the votes are a leading indicator. Now, I was given privileged information by that minister when he told me that. But actually, I didn't believe it. I just thought it was like a CEO bigging up, you know, like a Tory bigging up the chances just before the election. I just assumed it was that. So there are all sorts of different ways. You might have heard somebody going, there's going to be an election in the pub, but there's a million different ways of interpreting what you hear.
Yeah.
You don't actually know that it's true.
Yeah. I mean, I had it on reasonably good authority that Liz Truss was going to be sacked a few days before she was sacked. Now, I know that was not most surprising thing in the world. But
it actually wasn't
a heavily odds-on bet. It was at a time where it was like, well, she could steady the ship and keep going to the end of the year.
Yeah.
So I put money on her leaving before the end of the year. And very soon later, she resigned. Was that cheating? I mean, I don't know where you draw the line here. It's a much more interesting legal definition than men and women.
I'll say, you use what you know, and I think it boils down to the fact that if you're going to offer, I had never thought about this, but listening to you, you've orange-pilled me, red-pilled me, blue-pilled me, I don't even know what colour pill
shade,
it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it's you're offering odds on something where there is privileged information and that privileged information is likely to escape, well, then the risk is on you for offering the odds, surely.
I think so. We'll see.
I can see that.
Can I say one little thing about... I think the problem with this is when it comes to insider dealing in the stock market. And I think what's happened is there's some kind of crossover between gambling and insider dealing has gone on in the minds of everyone. And so in order to get to the bottom of it, you need to distinguish between stock market insider dealing, which is one thing, and gambling when you have proprietary knowledge, which might not actually be proprietary knowledge.
Yeah, because they clamp down a lot on insider trading. Well,
yeah,
they're supposed to. I mean, obviously, a lot. You can tell a lot of it goes
it
on.
It goes on
following
all the time,
stock market movements, but it is very illegal if you get caught doing it.
And rightly so, because when you have inside information that hasn't been disclosed to the market yet, you know, it's worth a great deal of money, and you can make a fortune at somebody else's expense.
But yeah, leave the political bettors alone will be the distinction.
It's not the same.
No, absolutely. Shall we talk about alcohol? There's been another study, another claim made about how essentially that there's no safe level of drinking. This particular study is claiming that when it comes particularly to cancer and also cardiovascular disease, that even people who are drinking within their meager allotted units each week are putting themselves at horrendous risk. Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit more about
We have these low risk guidelines, as they're called, which were gerrymandered essentially in 2016. So it's 14 units for men and women a week. That is about 10, 11 pints of lager a week. It is not very much. Most people apparently abide by this, but not because they know about the limits. It's most people don't drink very much, right? You know, a lot of people don't drink at all. Most people aren't what I would call actual drinkers, and actual drinkers don't pay any attention to the guidelines. And only 20% of the population even know what the guideline is after all these years.
I'm surprised it's that high.
The study looks at that a while ago. Yeah, so one in five people have any idea what the actual guidelines are. So they don't really matter, except they do to the temperance lobby, who would like to bring them down to zero because they want to treat alcohol like smoking and say there is no safe level. So Alcohol Change UK, which is a state-funded organisation formed of what used to be Alcohol Concern and Alcohol Research UK, they commissioned the Behavioural Insights team.
The Nudge Unit.
The Nudge Unit, the now privatised Nudge Unit, to do a bit of research in this area. And they did like the crudest possible epidemiology, where they did a survey, I think probably an online survey, a few thousand people. And how much, you know, just said, how much do you drink? Usual, you know, demographic characteristics, you know, man, woman, age, all the rest of it. And then asked them, have you ever had experience with cancer, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, and so on. And didn't adjust any of this for age or socioeconomic status or anything that a fairly basic epidemiological study would do. They just gave them the raw data. And supposedly this showed that only 1% of teetotalers had experience of cardiovascular disease, but 4 or 5% of people are drinking at low levels. The implication being that drinking the bare pittance that the government approves of is going to quadruple or quintuple your chances of getting heart disease. Now, if this were true, you'd think it probably would have been picked up in the massive epidemiological studies that have been going on for 50 years, which involve hundreds of thousands of people, but it hasn't. In fact, what those studies show is that you're at lower risk of heart disease if you're a moderate drinker.
Really? Somebody who's a low-level drinker has a lower rate of heart disease than someone who doesn't drink at all?
Yeah. Very, very much so. This has been shown again and again and again. The temperance lobby hates it, and so you keep reading different headlines, mixed messages, because they're trying to constantly sow confusion. But no, you're looking at about 25% reduction in heart disease, also stroke.
Against a teetotaler?
Against a lifelong teetotaler, yeah. So this was published. It got a bit of pickup, but I was most interested in what David Nutt had to say. You know David Nutt. Professor David Nutt. So he's the guy who got sacked years ago for saying that horse riding is safer than taking ecstasy. You must remember that, Dominic, don't you?
No.
You don't?
I don't follow the news that closely.
He's a big pro-drugs guy. But he's obsessed with alcohol, isn't he? He's developing his safe alcohol alternative.
Chaperone.
All that. I didn't realise it.
That's what it's called.
Got a brand name. That's
so he's basically, Tom's right. He's very pro-drugs. He's very pro-legalisation. He's very sound on vaping. He's a real curate's egg, actually. He's sound on a lot of things. But there's this real blind spot for alcohol, which he's really against. And I guess you could say as a conflict of interest, because he's basically trying to create what is essentially a legal high, which mimics alcohol. But I don't think that's what it is, actually. I think he's just got to be in his bonnet about it. So he got sacked years ago under Gordon Brown because he was on the government's drug advisory board. And his big thing is like doing league tables of risk for different substances. And they're pretty counterintuitive, some of these things, because it would suggest that you are much better off taking ketamine than you are having a glass of wine and stuff like this. He doesn't look at the socioeconomic, the social context of any of this stuff. It's all about health and risk. And
yeah, and so, does it take into account the quality of the ketamine and where you buy it and the risk you take buying the ketamine and all that kind of thing?
So I imagine David Nutt's getting the good stuff.
What he should do is assume there's a legal market and this stuff is pure, but I'm not sure whether he does or not. Anyway, he still puts alcohol right at the top of anything. So he got involved with this press release. And he said, there are people who think I've got 14 units, 14 units a week to before I get to my limit. I've got 14 units. I can have 7 drinks on a Friday, 7 on a Saturday. That's okay. Well, firstly, as I say, only 1 in 5 people even know what the guidelines are. And I'm pretty sure the rest of them don't care, either because they hardly drink or because they drink a lot. I don't believe there's really anyone who thinks I'm going to split it over a Friday and a Saturday. And even if they did, that's only 3 pints a night, right? So is that a problem? He said, we know that drinking the maximum allowance in one or two goes is very dangerous. Not just dangerous, very dangerous. So 3 pints on a Friday, and then 3 pints on a Saturday, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's what you have at lunchtime.
More so than horse riding over that time, or horse riding with some ketamine.
This is vastly...
I don't want to overcomplicate
this. It's even more dangerous than horse riding. I think he didn't say that. But that's
he's learnt not to go back to that comparison.
That's the implication. Yeah. And so it's just, well, this David Nutt's being silly again. A temperance organisation is trying to scare people. But they're not even happy now with you drinking at the pathetic level of 14 units a week. They've got to go after that. We are going towards this kind of zero tolerance approach to alcohol because these people are imitating very overtly the anti-smoking lobby, where they say no, not just no safe level of smoking, no safe level of passive smoking. And once you have a guideline that is essentially zero, then every drinker is drinking at an unsafe level. And if you don't think the government is going to respond to that with some vigorous action, then I've got a bridge to sell you. But that's the way it's going. There's so much of this going on at the moment. With the Surgeon General in America a few months ago saying we need cancer warnings on alcohol. It's all about, let's hammer home this message. There's no safe level. It causes cancer. Basically, it's like cigarettes. That's the message.
What do you make of this, Dominic? As someone who's both a libertarian, but also a very clean living man these days.
Well, I am a clean living man, and I've dramatically cut down my alcohol consumption. And I think at one point in the distant past, I did know what the safe level was, because my dad used to talk about it. This is like 35 years ago. And I was so far above it that I think I just blocked
it
out.
It was a lot higher 35 years ago.
Oh, was it? I always thought it was 20.
It was 28 35 years ago. Go back even further, it was 56.
Oh my goodness.
And that was mandatory in those days as well. Those slightly different times.
Yeah. Well, as Simon Evans often said, that means you could drink every night of the week. I'll probably get this wrong because I'm not a professional comedian. You could split that over 7 days, like David Nutt would assume we do, and you will be drunk. Not just, you'll be over the drink drive limit. You'll be unable to drive, not just legally, but actually unable to drive.
Those were the days.
But I think there is evidence that you know, a bit like sugar, we used to drink much more than we do now.
Yeah, yes. Exactly right, yeah.
But in any case, I used to drink a lot, and in the last couple of years, I've dramatically cut down the amount that I drink. And I will say that I feel a lot better for it.
Look better for it, Dominic, as well.
Thank you. And I've lost weight, and I just feel generally better and stronger. And a lot of the bad decisions I've made over the course of my life can be attributed to alcohol. So I'm currently in the camp of, it is not such a bad thing if you cut down your drink. Mm-hmm. But I cut down my drink not as a result of some government study or some government guidelines or anything else. I needed to lose some weight, and I wanted to just sort of clear my head a bit and take a bit more control of my life and so on. And I just cut down as a result of, you know, following health bros on Twitter and that kind of thing. And so,
are you now within the 14 unit limit?
I'm probably around about that, 15 units. I mean, I do drink 2 or 3 days a week, and I'll have 2 or 3 pints. When I go.
So
on
even
stage,
you, who has made a point of really cutting down and going on a health kick, still exceeding these stupid limits.
David
well, it
Knight
depends
still
on how many gigs
you.
I have, because I'm funnier after a pint, so I tend to have like half a pint before I go on stage. So if I'm doing gigs over the course of the night, I'll drink a pint, maybe 2 pints. So, you know, so part of it is lifestyle. And the main thing is I just stopped drinking at home. But in any case, all of that is as a result of my own choice and my own people I follow and my own experience. And I just don't think we need the government to tell us how much we can and can't drink. The other thing that, listened to you talk, that it sparked off was Wayne Wheeler was the American who was behind the
anti-temperance
movement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the temperance movement. And the reason that he was such a anti-temperance, you know, nut job was that when he was a little boy, he was stabbed on his farm by one of the farmhands who was just drunk with a pitchfork, stabbed him in his leg and left him with a sort of lifelong injury. And that left him with a lifelong hatred of alcohol. And so his hatred of alcohol was as a result of bitter personal experience. And I think the evidence, when I said people used to drink a lot more, I was thinking, you know, late 19th century USA, I think alcohol consumption was very high, particularly in amongst Northern European emigrants, Irish, German, British, all the rest of it. In any case, I think if you were to look at, I don't know, this guy, David Nutt, but it wouldn't surprise me. A lot of them have had a bitter experience with alcohol. Maybe they have a parent that's an alcoholic or something like that. And I say this, you know, my ex is an alcoholic and it's bad. You know, alcoholism is bad and it really can hurt people. But one person's experience is not everyone's experience. And a lot of these temperance campaigners, if you delve around in your path in their past, a bit like Wayne Wheeler, you might find there is some early trauma in their lives that has given them this, that has put them on this mission.
Some of it might be, but you know, when I did my book about the history of anti-smoking, Velvet Glove Iron Fist, available on Amazon, I was expecting to find lots of colourful characters with that kind of story or religious maniacs, and there were in that era, the late 19th, early 20th century. These days are this professional lobbyists, really. They haven't even got an interesting backstory half the time, or more than half the time. They just do it as a job. They go from one job to another. I don't think they care particularly about the issue.
And so it's all part of the blob, essentially. It's part of the legislation and regulation of everything, and these bodies are paid large amounts of money by the government subsidy to exist, and so they make it their life to tell everyone else what to do.
Yeah, it's just a job for them. You know, they get paid to campaign. They don't really care what they campaign about. Deborah Arnott at Action Smoke and Health, I only found this out quite recently. When she took the job many years ago, 2003 or something like that, she was a smoker at the time. She only quit after she became the head of Britain's leading anti-smoking charity. And she, before that, she was a TV
producer.
Was
she doing that to try to quit, maybe? She thought this would be the incentive I finally need to...
Give you an incentive, I guess. Yeah. Not to be caught by the paparazzi or something, having a cheeky fact. But she's quit now,
There you go.
So she can now start again if she wants to.
I'm sure at the beginning of this show, when you get me on, you have a little sweepstake sometimes before I get here. At what point in the show I mention the evils of fiat money?
Here we go.
We've reached that point. But this, you know, all this endless expansion of government and all this subsidy and all this thing would not be possible if government didn't have the power to create money.
Wouldn't it?
No,
they wouldn't be able to fund their own pressure groups. Why not?
Because there isn't the revenue. It's only the endless expansion of credit that enables them to do it.
Well, they still have tax revenue.
Yeah, but the tax revenue isn't enough to cover all these expenses by a long chalk.
Well, it depends what they prioritise. They might prioritise anti-smoking groups over everything else. No. But, you know,
that'd be quite unlikely.
If government didn't have the power to issue money at no cost to itself, it would not be possible for government and all these bodies to grow and blob to the same extent.
Don't know about that, but
one for another day. Shall we talk about the other story you wanted to bring up? We've got one more, which is something that you wrote about on your Substack, which is that there's this group of young, enterprising, socially conscious youngsters in Lambeth and Southwark, I understand, who have been presumably taking their paper hour money and all the rest of it and getting together and putting these billboards up, decrying the state of junk food advertising in their areas. They're really taking a stand. I've been quite moved by it, really. Do you want to tell us a bit about what's been going on here? The fact that they've done this entirely, seemingly, of their own volition.
Yes. Well, it shows how politically engaged and compassionate Gen X are. Gen Z, I should say, are.
Particularly in South London for some reason. But
Apparently, they have paid Dominic for 365 ad spaces in the specifically Lambeth and is it Suffolk? Mm-hmm. Suffolk area. Is it your manor?
Well, I'm Lewisham, but...
There are lots of wealthy teenagers in your manor.
There are lots of wealthy teenagers in Lewisham, Lambeth and Southwark, but there are also lots of teenagers in the area with, I'm sure we're about to discover, wealthy connections. And there are, you know, it's also a very heavily left-wing area and it's a very subsidy-tastic area as well.
So these adverts, I can't remember what they said now. Can you remember exactly? I mean, the gist was it said something like, young activists have bought up this ad space to stop junk food companies buying it. And it's more or less word for word what it says. Some of these are on buses, which is part of TfL, and TfL already banned so-called junk food advertising. So they slightly missed the point there. But hundreds of adverts.
They should have some advertising body come and wrap their knuckles.
I was thinking about contacts in the Advertising Standards Authority, but as usual, I couldn't be bothered.
You want to snitch on these poor kids?
If any viewers or listeners fancy making a complaint to the ASA, it probably is genuinely worthwhile because for two reasons. Firstly, the so-called junk food companies couldn't buy a lot of that space anyway. And secondly, and this is really the point, I am very sceptical whether young activists actually spent hundreds of thousands of pounds buying up advertising space in London. I don't believe, A, they've got the money, and B, I don't think they care that much about advertising. The person who does care about this is Jamie Oliver, who founded an organisation called Bite Back 2030 some years ago after his businesses all collapsed and he'd succeeded in getting the sugar tax through, and an organisation called Impact on Urban Health, I think it's called, which is part of the Guy's and St. Thomas's Trust, which is this vast, has tens of millions of pounds a year to dish out to people. And it gives, I think, most of it to Impact on Urban Health. And it's from Bite Back and Impact on Urban Health I learnt about this particular stunt. I should say, it is possible that these guys got together and they went out with buckets in the streets of Lambeth getting money off young activists.
I didn't see them.
And the young activists then took that money and booked all this advertising space and gave them the wording and designed the graphic and put the Impact on Urban Health logo
it's
on.
It's the sort of thing you do when you're that age, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. 17-year-old. We've all been there, haven't we?
Absolutely.
You know, we're young and reckless, buying up advertising space to stop corporations using it. On the other hand, it's possible that it was just these very large multi-million pound do-gooding charities did this, and this is an obvious example of astroturfing. You decide, listeners and viewers, you decide.
What do you make of this, Dominic?
I think he's absolutely right. I think they've been rumbled, and I think we need a definition
for legal reasons. It's a thought experiment. Like, why would they want to do this?
But, my kids are in that demographic, and I wasn't aware of any of them collecting
there
money.
There is this trend, though, isn't there, to try to the very least put young people at the forefront of these campaigns. You saw it with the climate strikes, or you saw it with various different things where it's hard to believe that this is generated entirely naturally. We're going to be diplomatic about it. Would you say that's a bit of a trend that we're seeing?
I would say it's young people have been used in advertising of any kind since forever. And, they're charismatic and we warm to them and we think of our future and all the rest of it. And obviously we don't think about the future of young people because we're all selfish. I don't mean that. And to me, it's pretty obvious what's happened. And I hope not the young people. I hope the perpetrators behind it get some kind of comeuppance.
Yeah. So go to the ASA. Lodge a complaint.
Absolutely.
Folks, let's see how it goes. I think there's a real chance of victory here.
Do you think?
Yeah.
So we start a campaign off the back of this podcast. To find out what's going on.
We're going to bite back.
Exactly.
We'll bite back, and Jamie Oliver's lot will get bollocked for false advertising in their own advertising campaign, complaining about other people's advertising.
But the problem is because the message is good, they might not have their knuckles wrapped quite as hard as they otherwise would.
Possibly. I don't know where the ASA stands on that. It is an industry-funded body, which doesn't mean it's biased towards industry. If you look at its judgments, it clearly isn't. But nor would you think is it completely taken over by left-wing loons. I don't know.
We shall find out. We'll put some sort of email template up on the website that people can copy and paste.
I can't see how far doing that. I might as well just do it myself.
Under all your various different aliases. Shall we reach into the post bag?
Post bag, post bag, post bag.
It's bulging, eh?
Let's reach into the post bag, see what our listeners and viewers have been sending us messages about. There's one here for you, Dominic.
Oh.
It's a bit personal. This is from Grope de Cologne on X, full name, I'm sure. Where did Dominic's cut glass English accent come from? Presumably because you're English, but was it inherited, inculcated, or did you start out estuary or northern and decide to work on it?
Well, a bit of both. I grew up in London, but I went to public school, so I'm sort of a little bit posh, but not as posh as somebody who went to public school in a countryside. But my dad was an actor and put great importance on voice and speech, and I trained as an actor, and so I spent a good 10 years of my life working really hard, like a physical thing, like you would a sport, learning to speak as well and properly and clearly as possible. And actually my speech has got a lot worse as I've got older. I've got awful A sounds, which I didn't used to have, and then as a result of all that, I spent most of my life working life, doing voiceovers and doing it that way. But it was something I guess I was slightly born into by virtue of the fact that I was English and went to public school, but mainly because I had a theatrical father. And also just working in theatres when you're young, having to fill big spaces, develops your diction. And one of the reasons why diction is so bad now compared to what it was in the 50s is the microphone. We don't need diction in the way that we once did in order to bring to project your voice clearly. So it was something I worked at, basically.
There you go. So it stood you in good stead, isn't it?
I paid off well with all the voiceover work.
I think so. And I mean, I get really wound up when I see people speaking badly, particularly broadcasters, people in positions of power. It really winds me up.
Because, of course, on top of your voiceover work, you've got all this satirical comedy song and pieces that you put out. So you can clearly see where that has benefited for you. But Chris,
a lot of those songs you wouldn't be able to do, because I speak a lot of them, I have to speak so clearly. And obviously, if you don't hear the words, you don't laugh because you don't hear what I'm saying. You know, that to be able to do that, you know, hopefully I make it look like it's quite easy, but it is actually quite hard and a lot of people wouldn't be able to do it.
Absolutely. And Chris, we've got a question here in the run up to the local elections.
Yeah.
Which is asking.
Looking forward to those.
Is anyone else gripped? I mean, it could be quite interesting.
Are we purdy yet?
We've got an unpopular government. We've got reform coming through. Who knows? But may be your last.
Reform have got their own problems.
They do. They very much do. Who doesn't? this is a question from Freedom Not Tyranny. Again, I'm sure that's their Christian name. This may be your last episode before local elections happening on the 1st of May. What particularly dumb things have you seen local authorities do in recent years? Anything in your neck of the woods?
Not really.
Fair enough, Dominic.
I was talking to Dominic before about houseboats. We've got a lot of houseboats.
In your part of the world.
Yeah, and they're allowed to dump their sewage into the river at high tide, which I think is a bit out of order. Don't want to start coming over old Fergal Sharky, like, but, you know, they're worth a lot of money, these houseboats, these days. One of them was on Grand Designs recently. Folks, if you want to watch Grand Designs, you'll see where I live. It's just described as being near Worthing, which I thought was a bit insulting. But the council allowed them to get away with that. So
I'm surprised, because I used to live on a boat on the river, that was in London, in fact, here in Canary Wharf, and you were not allowed to put your sewage into the river under any circumstances. You had to go and get it pumped out.
Yeah, rightly so.
Yeah. But
apparently different rules in my neck of the woods.
I was walking here, and I saw a sign for Lambeth Council on the way here, and I haven't got my phone to grab, and because I took a photo of the sign, I have no idea what it means, but it said, sorry, Lewisham Council, and it said Lewisham Council is the first council that is a sanctuary, and I have no idea what that means.
Bird sanctuary?
No, they had a sort of image of two must be something, I don't know.
Because that's a very American thing, to be a sanctuary city is like a thing in America where they would say that, you know, we're welcoming of refugees or something. Maybe they've just cribbed that. I don't know. It is actually wild.
There's some
life.
Adverts on the tube at the moment, you must have seen, from the Mayor of London, who spends a lot of money advertising himself, doesn't he?
Yep.
So it says
he's got to fill the gap left by all those McDonald's ads.
Everyone is loved and welcomed in London. It's like, well, how can you lie? That's another one for the advertising standards authority. There's one place I've ever been to where people are not loved and welcomed. It's London.
London.
It's the coldest, friendliest place in the country.
Incredible. Right, let's there's one that's been actually in the bag for some time, which I thought it might be worth us discussing. So, spotted Chris Whitty in Tesco Express this week. This is a few weeks ago, but still.
Oh, yeah.
It's an interesting story in and of itself. Huge disappointment was not seeing him buying tabs. What product would you like to see Keir Starmer buying? Is that just something kind of hypocritical? Just something incriminating?
You're really springing some questions on.
No, exactly.
Well, I can tell you, I would like to see him buying beef tallow.
Say more, please.
Beef dripping, because that entire cabinet, but David Lammy and Keir Starmer in particular, have way too much seed oil in their diet, and they need to reduce it for the good of their own health and replace vegetable oils with either lard or beef dripping.
So this is another one of your kind of health awakenings.
The health bros. You're not worried about your cholesterol?
No.
Cholesterol's in good nick, is it?
No, my cholesterol's fine. It's. We've talked about it before, Chris, and you expressed doubt.
Well, I don't know,
slightly disparaging doubt in the same way you did my fiat money argument. But the...
I think Chris's body is a temple as well. He just gets there with a slightly different route.
The all those vegetable oils, rapeseed oil and sunflower oil and all that, that we deep fry everything. I know correlation is not causation, but the more we use them, the more obese people get. And when we used to deep fry stuff in tallow and beef dripping.
Yeah, you can say about a lot of things, can't you? Except, well, people don't smoke anymore. That's why they got fat.
Yeah, there's
all sorts of people aren't as sexist as they used to be. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's true.
Maybe seed oil is a bad for you.
Let's just go back to how we were in the 70s when people were slim. In every respect.
Also, as you say, Dominic, correlation isn't causation. But I have noticed a lot of comedians are quite into, you know, health these days. We've had we had Leo Kirst on a few weeks ago. Yeah. We got into
arguing
this a little
in favor
bit.
Of the nanny stuff.
We even noticed that Lewis Schaefer has gotten bang into his,
he's got a big thing about
things like that.
His protein.
He's very paleo, isn't he?
Yeah. Protein. Is there a kind of crossover here? Is this the Joe Rogan influence? Is it?
No, it's been like that for a long time. I can remember maybe 20 years ago, even the Perrier, all the nominees for the Perrier Award, which was the Edinburgh Comedy Award, was then the biggest award in comedy. Maybe 2004, something like that. They were all teetotal. And it was like, oh, where did that come from?
Is that why I was sponsored by Perrier? Because that was the prime market for it.
I guess so. No, it's one of those weird legacy things. And Perrier abandoned it after a certain point. But, you know, the idea of the sort of the hell-raising, drinking, all that comedian, it's slightly, you know, a lot of comedians, there are some that drink a lot and do drugs and all the rest of it, but a lot of very clean living. And in fact, one thing you notice with comics is they may not be, like, you know, have the highest IQs, but a lot of very good comics have fantastic recall.
Mm.
And you see it with, you know, Peter Kay and Ross Noble. They've just got this ability to recall trivial stuff from a long time ago. Like, if you talk to Peter Kay about theme tunes of music from the 1970s, they do very well in quizzes, comedians often do. And they've got this recall thing, and booze goes against that. So somebody, even like Peter Kay, you know, he's very much last generation of comic and may not be the healthiest man in the world, but he never drank.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, it's quite common.
Very interesting.
I'd like to see Keir Starmer buy Madry.
Mm. Just because it's your new favourite brand?
Theoretically my favourite lager, yeah.
Mm.
Isn't Madry another beer? Isn't it it's a front?
No, unfortunately that's an urban myth. People say it's just Carling with a few more hops.
Yeah.
But I'm told it's not. It is made, I think, by the same people who make Carling. It's certainly made in Britain. That's the funny thing about
it. Yeah, so they branded Spanish. It to look like it's
whereas
Spanish
the Lidl or version or the Aldi version, which is very clearly copying the packaging, is actually made in Spain. Lucy Letby Corner. I will be at a event discussing the case at Unheard on Wednesday.
So if anyone...
Throw that in. I want a few people there who are not crazy in the audience.
Exactly.
To help me out.
So you've got to be on Chris's side if you want to come to this. That's the one.
Preferably,
condition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I would take on Letby.
I don't.
Okay. Move on.
That's Lucy Letby Corner concluded. And very finally, Dominic, because we are a very libertarian, anti-ban podcast, we always ask our guests, if you had to have one ban, what would it be? The only conditions that we attach to this is it can't be anything too worthy or too sort of meaningful. It's just got to be something that really irritates you, irks you on a day-to-day basis. That if you were to, for a moment, indulge your kind of inner dictator, what would you stamp out and get rid of?
You are a dictator. Ah.
The fact that British people have to go into a different queue in passport control when they go into Europe.
Mm.
You ban that?
Yes.
Well, you voted Brexit.
I know.
Wrote a song about it. So are you a regretter?
I'm a regretter about that.
But the queues aren't any different to what they were before.
No,
sometimes it can be a boon getting into...
Of all places, I was in the queue for Switzerland. It took me an hour and a half to get through passport control in Switzerland. Like, why did Switzerland do it?
And it's annoyingly spiteful
the
as
first,
well, isn't it?
It's exactly what it was.
Because we don't do it in the other direction.
We don't. And it was a petty and spiteful measure. And if I was a politician negotiating some bollocks with you know, fishing rights or something, whatever Keir Starmer's negotiating at the moment, I would go, okay, fine, you can have whatever you want, but we want no queues in passport control. That's my ban.
Or you want to be in the same queue as EU citizens,
yeah,
is what you mean.
That's my ban.
I've never
And I'm going to have a million people tell me I'm a hypocrite.
Well, you are, yeah.
That's my ban.
Yeah.
This is the... We were allowed to be hypocrites. In
Absolutely.
This,
this is the safe space in which that's allowed to happen. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Last Orders. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you subscribe and click the bell so that you never miss another Spiked video. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, make sure you subscribe there and leave us a glowing 5-star review. And if you'd like to get in touch with your questions or band suggestions, email us at lastorders@spiked-online.com.